All right, we are in the managed world again. VisualStudio.net, CLR, all that good stuff. Yep. Who are you?
My name is Jesse Kaplan. I'm a program manager on the Common Language Runtime team, primarily focusing on managed native interop.
Excellent. Hi.
I'm Raja Krishnaswamy. I'm an architect in CLR. I'm a dev lead for some of the other areas as well. I'm an architect for interop and security.
Excellent. So speaking of interop, there's this feature, no PIAs. Mm-hmm. What is it? What's the point?
So no PIAs isn't a banishment of PIAs or anything like that. It's the ability for you to not have to use them.
Okay.
So for those of you who need a little bit of primer for just wondering what we talk about these things as, a PIA is the managed representation of a COM interface or a set of COM interfaces in a TLB. And what happens is you use TLBimp, you give it a type library, and it creates a managed assembly for you. And this managed assembly is what managed code uses to talk to native COM components. So in the old days, what happened was the publisher of the TLB usually would create one of these interop assemblies and then sign it and tell everybody, hey, everybody, use this one. This is the PIA that you should all use, and if you all use this, you'll all be able to exchange types between each other because you're all using the same interop assembly. Anybody could always go and do TLBimp on the TLB and create their own version of it, but they wouldn't be able to talk to anybody else because that other person's managed type is different than the one I included in my app. It's a different assembly, so it's a different type. And that generally worked for those purposes, but it caused a few problems. The first off is you have to figure out who deploys the PIA. So if you look at a large native app with one of these things, that native app needs to deploy the PIA and needs to put it in the GAC so that all managed code can read it.
Mm.
The problem is these are native apps typically, and often they don't require the runtime to be installed because they don't use it themselves, so they have no way to install the PIA. So that gets then pushed on to the add-in developers who code up against these large native apps. And then so they now have to deploy the PIA. The problem is for an app the size of Office, your PIAs can be 10 megabytes and greater. And so you can have a small Office add-in that just needs to talk to a few functions in Excel, and it's 50K, and it brings with it a 10 to 20 megabyte redist.
Mm.
It brings all the Office PIAs with it. So that obviously causes
causes
some concern to the add-in developer. And there have been a lot of nasty tricks in setup that have been played over the years with various unfortunate consequences to try and make that easier. But the basic problem is there's no good way to deploy the PIA, and even at runtime, if you just need to use 20K worth of interfaces, you're loading up these giant, like, 2-megabyte Excel PIAs that have all the basic Office interfaces defined in them, even though you only needed a small percentage of those.
Hmm.
So what no PIAs is basically two parts to this feature. There's compiler changes to the C# and VB compilers, and of course anybody else can do the same, and the language teams are providing guidance on how other compilers could do this. But basically what they do is they look at someone who's consuming any interop assembly, primary or not. They look at the portion of the interop assembly that that app actually uses, say the 10 methods off 4 or 5 different interfaces, and brings a copy of those interfaces, those definitions, into the local assembly. So now you don't need the whole assembly. You just need the pieces of that interface, pieces of those type libraries that you use.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the runtime side, we look at these things and say, you know what, these interfaces all are describing the same COM interface, all describing the same COM type. And so the CLR's part of that world is letting the handshake between different people who did this, let them say these types are equivalent. So we call this type equivalence. So you've got two interfaces, they have the same COM GUID on it, they've both been imported from an interop assembly into the local assemblies for the various add-ins. We're going to let you exchange types between these different assemblies, even though they're not really the same type as far as the runtime is concerned. And so between those two halves of it, the PIAs become a design time artifact. You give them to people as part of your SDK. They never need to be on the machine at runtime. They never need to be loaded up at runtime. And it solves most of those problems we just talked about.
Excellent. So
Jesse has done a good job explaining it. I mean, I'll add a few things that he missed, mostly. It's like, I'm adding a few things extra to...
Well, he's an architect. What are you going to do?
No, the design time part is basically, you know, it's useful for IntelliSense. That's one of the reasons it's there, right?
Mm.
If you add a primary interrupt assembly, that design time C# will show you all this nice, all the methods that are available on. So it makes sense for design time. The other part is the size is big. But Office, actually, for every version of Office they shipped, like 2003, 2007, they have different peers as well. So it's, if you're building a simple add-in that you want to run on both 2003 and 2007, you either build different add-ins, which bring different readers, or bring both of them, I guess. So that's probably the gist of from the scenario-wise. I mean, going back to V1, we did a lot of work. I mean, CLR has always been saying, you know, work well at calm. Right? Mm-hmm. That's... We did a bunch of work, CCWs, RCWs, right?
Rush did it in a weekend.
So we did a lot of investment, and at that time, when we did all of them, we allowed people to have different interfaces to talk to the same comm guy. And when the issue of saying, how do I exchange type came along, we said, hey, primary interrupts, and we solved it. So we let it at that. And people have used it, and they, you know, kept saying, hey, you've done all this work in CLR, why can't you just get this also, like, you know, cleaned up, so it's much easier. So that's one of the reasons we went and looked at it this time.
So. Excellent. So let's talk a little bit about that cleaning up. This is CLR 4 or CLR 3, depending on, you know, if you want to talk about versioning in the strict sense or the marketing sense. So in CLR 4, let's talk about exactly what you guys did. It's great description. I think we all understand the problem now. How did you solve it precisely?
So, as I mentioned, CLR already had a lot of hooks in the engine to know, like, you know, hey, if an object is a COM object, and if an interface is COM-based interfaces, because there's a flag that says COM import on it, because I got imported from COM, and there are, like, Marshall's attributes, VTable slots, there's a whole bunch of stuff that's already in there that CLR understands. And, you know, when we had RCWs, we allowed you to get an IN known, wrap it with an RCW, and you should be able to cast it to any interface you want, even though that RCW type really didn't implement in your firm, right?
Mm.
So we had hooks in the engine and all the places, right? The type system, places where you do a cast, or like where you invoke a method. We had plugged into those to actually dispatch it. So in order to enable this particular mechanism now, we had to go back to the same places and a few more, and, you know, actually, a little bit more than we expected, actually. Because usually, like, you know, when you build a feature like this, it interacts with all the other features in the CLR, right? So it requires a little bit of careful engineering, and we had some very good people. We had some very good devs and another architect as well who helped carefully engineer it so that we can actually make sure, like, you know, when you see these two interfaces that have some specific attributes, like COM import, and we have this new type entity attribute, that they are, you know, construct as equivalent, and make sure when you do the cast, when you do a dispatch, and when you do like various combinations like virtuals and overrides, you can look at those cases and say, okay, these things are equivalent, treat them as equivalent.
Excellent.
So,
very cool.
This is the first time that I know of in the type system where you can take two types that are fundamentally very different from each other. They may not have anything in common but the name and the GUID, and be able to exchange something, pass one of one to the other. Mm-hmm. So if two different people used different parts of a COM interface, they may have, one guy may have method A, B, and C, the other guy has methods D, E, and F defined in their interfaces. And if you look at the metadata, there's going to be this thing called a VTable gap in there, which helps us do the layout in memory. But if you look at it, they don't share the same methods, but you'll be able to take an object typed as one and pass it to the other. So there was definitely a lot of changes to make sure that was safe.
Mm.
And if you passed one to the other, we're not going to just start executing random memory. Mm. That we'll check is like, hey, does the object actually implement something at this VTable slot? If it does, is the method there the one I expect it to be?
Mm.
So we now, these are different interfaces, we don't know that they imported the same PIA, for example. Maybe that the interop assembly changed over time, or someone handcrafted it, and the method signatures wouldn't match up in such a way where the system was still type-saved.
Mm.
So we had to put in a lot of restrictions to make sure that that still worked and that we could verify. It's like, you know what, not only are these interfaces the same as far as COM is concerned, but the method we're about to dispatch is equivalent enough that we can make things work.
So, I mean, I can expand on it, right? It really depends on what the target is. If you look at office scenario, office is COM-based. Mm-hmm. But there are multiple consumers who are building add-ins, right, that talk to office. So I have a partial interface to talk to Excel, and I have a partial interface to talk to Excel. It kind of works out okay, because I talk to iXL with three methods. I give you the same iXL to you, and you're going to talk to different three methods to a COM guy. That's okay. But if Excel become managed, that's when it gets interesting. Hey, you know, is he implementing the full set of what the original contract specification was? If somebody said, like, hey, you know, the original contract specification for the COM interface has like six methods, I choose to implement only four of them, or as Jesse was pointing out, I implement the different signature, then when we dispatch the calls, are we safe? Because when you go to COM, we always said, like, you know, it's full trust, right? You better define the interface properly and use it. It's like PInvoke, right? If you're talking to COM component, he expects an interface with slot number three, you better have, like, you know, slot number three. Because COM is going to call you, and, you know, you better implement it correctly. That's the rule we specify. The question is, like, what if the client was managed and the provider was managed? In those cases, we still use vTables, because it is designed right now as a COM-based feature, to figure out, like, given this particular interface, this slot number, where would I dispatch? Find an equivalent guy, see if it has valid slot number, see if there's a method, then we make sure the signatures match. If it matches, the calls go through. Otherwise, we throw an exception. So it's safe. So, I mean, you can imagine it looks like a little bit like duck typing. But if people are following the contracts correctly, I think it works out okay.
Yeah, if people just use the compilers and go against the POs, they use the compilers do the magic for them, they never have to think about this stuff. They'll never actually know, as far as they can tell, that they have all this stuff in their assemblies. Mm-hmm. It's there just for metadata, it's just there just for marshalling, and they shouldn't really be able to notice it. It should behave exactly the same way as it did before. Most, at least for interop purposes, it does. And all they know is they don't have to deploy the PA anymore. And that's the basic thing. They shouldn't really notice a difference, except things get simpler. They don't have to worry about the PA redist or size issues or working set.
Simpler is
good. Yeah.
I mean,
no, okay.
There are, like, interesting aspects of it. Like, yes. As long as the target is COM,
yeah,
you could use a different signature. Because, like, you know, I can have an IXL where I say, like, you know, I don't want to marshal something, and I can put an inputter, for example. As long as it's COM, when you go from managed to native, it works out okay, and you can use a different signature, and I can use a different signature. It's just that, like, if I'm going managed to manage, you better have the signatures match. Mm. We talked about maybe we could do some double thunking and, like, you know, make it go through native and come back, but, you know, they didn't get to do it. Lack of time and other reasons as well. But I think the concept, it works out very well for COM-based scenarios right now. And other people have thought, like, hey, you know, there's this loose coupling where, like, you know, I get to have my interface definition, you get to have one, and we can still communicate.
Without going through the
primary. Without having another shared thing, right, that we both have to reference.
Absolutely.
That's an interesting concept, and people are exploring it, whether it's useful outside of COM-based scenarios as well. But
now, I mean, it does, I mean, you know, nothing comes for free, right? So how does this impact sort of compatibility between, you know, if you have a program that relied on the old way, communicating with one that relies on the new way, it should be seamless?
Or at the same time, could have one assembly use via another one.
Yeah. We specifically made sure that if you ran or loaded an assembly that compiled against the PIA, mm-hmm, and didn't embed it, that we would make the PIA interfaces equivalent with the ones embedded in someone else's. Okay. So generally, for type equivalence, we look at whether or not there's this thing called the type identifier attribute. We say you have to opt into equivalence. Mm-hmm. So you'll have to apply this attribute to your type. In actuality, the compiler is going to apply it for you automatically when they embed the local definition. And once you have that attribute on there, you've opted into equivalence and things will work. But because there's this legacy case of people who've just written code against the PIAs and the PIAs are actually installed, what we do is we've automatically opted the PIAs into this.
Okay.
So that's, we said, they're automatically opted into equivalence, and so you can exchange a PIA type with a local type and it'll just work fine.
Excellent.
And so you shouldn't notice any compatibility issues as far as that's concerned.
Keep your fingers crossed.
Yes.
Yes. I mean, that's always something to think about when changes happen at that level. Now, this, of course, is related also to, when you mentioned it earlier, the changes in C-Sharp 4.0 for better support for COM. I don't know what they're calling it, but a better support for COM interop. I'm assuming this is related in the compiler work.
Yeah, we work with them closely on this. It's
absolutely.
Office, right? Like Office Programmer Team, VSTU, this team, they've been asking us for like quite a few time, and this release, we said, fine, we'll invest in it.
Excellent.
Yeah, it was four teams that worked very closely on getting all this together. It was the Office Programmability team, or the VSTO team, the VB and C-Sharp teams, and then the CLR team.
Mm-hmm.
And also a good chunk from VS as well, because they're one of those other big COM apps.
Yeah, now, that does bring up a good point, though, in the following sense. In one sense, it's cool that you don't have this massive shared kind of... this. One shared assembly that somebody owns and signs, and everybody has to install it, or at least compile with it. So the question I would ask, though, is if I'm writing code in a language that's not, or I haven't actually changed my compiler to support this feature, then I obviously have to use the interop assembly. So I guess one of the things about .NET was the notion of sharing things such that language doesn't matter. Now, F-Sharp, for example, will have to be able to communicate, I would imagine. They'll have to use the whole interop assembly. So what I'm trying to spit out is you mentioned C-Sharp and VB.
Yep.
Now, you made changes at the compiler level, which means C-Sharp and VB compilers are involved in this game. And so if I write something in a different programming language that is CLS compliant, .NET language, say F-Sharp, this might be an extreme example, I don't get this benefit because I haven't baked it into my compiler to support this.
Well,
right or wrong?
There are two parts that we need the compiler help on, right? One is the embedding itself, which is like how do you pull in the pipes automatically. That one, I would say, it just makes it easier. Rather than user typing it in themselves, the compiler actually saying, oh, I'll figure out which ones you need and pull it in.
Mm-hmm.
The second part is a more interesting one, which is if I'm building an assembly that's independent, right, then I can type it in, right? It's an attribute. I can say, hey, you know, type in the interface, put the type entry attribute, and my assembly works. And then I can give it to CLR, and it works fine.
Mm-hmm.
I think the case where it gets interesting is, like, if you try to mix and match assemblies, C# built one assembly that they pulled in some types, and it's exposed to some public signatures, and I want to reference that guy who has the local types, exposed to a public signature. A clear example would be like, you know, there's a virtual method that has this type, which is local. I want to override it. Now, if I want to have my own local type for the virtual override signature, for the compiler to allow it, yes, you need some compiler help.
Mm-hmm.
If you didn't need to do that, if you're just saying, hey, you know, I'm just building an assembly that's using F#, I can either reference a peer or I can pull in the peer types myself, then it works out okay. Unification is one that's interesting. We're going to document it, and we're going to see, like, you know, what the rules are. I think there are, like, a small set of rules that the C# compiler team has offered to write up, saying, hey, you know, whichever compiler team wants to opt in, they can start opting in.
Excellent.
Yeah, so we're working on providing the guidance on how to do that. If all the F# guy did is code against the peer, and hope that if at runtime he ends up getting a type from a different language like C# or VB and he wants them to be equivalent, then that will just work. They're, as far as we're concerned, just another piece of code that referenced the PIA, and the PIA is automatically opted into equivalence. It's only when he's referencing a different assembly that opted in and had the embedded types where you could potentially run into this issue. And if all you want to do is pass the objects around, then you can do some casting and other stuff. But if you start wanting, if you want to inherit from a base class in a different assembly, that's when you really do need the compiler's help. And so, yes, there will be additional guidance for that.
Cool. Because, I mean, it's sort of, it should, might happen. Might be a
start.
I mean, I'd imagine most people are using PIAs for Office. I mean, in reality, in the real world, most people are probably interacting with COM while writing add-ins for Office, right? Most managed developers aren't doing a lot of COM interop unless they're playing with Office, is what I'm trying to say. True or false?
Shell.
Shell. Shell extensions.
So that's, there are third parties as well. There are a bunch of other people who have Conf frameworks out there. If you know there are a bunch of third parties that I know we know of.
Excel and Office are one of the biggest development platforms in the world, obviously.
Absolutely.
So yes, there are a ton of people doing that, but there are
They
are far from our only customer. Yeah. VS is another good example, and there are lots of people who code against VS.
Writing add-ins
and new languages for VS.
Good point.
All those extensibility points. And the common thread is those are both big com apps. And Microsoft definitely is not the only people who have written big com apps in the past. So there's a lot of third parties we work with.
There's a lot of comments up there.
Sure.
Excellent, man. So how about, you know, let's talk a little bit about maybe, you know, hard engineering problems in this particular. Like, what was the thing that was like, wow, man, this is going to be really hard, and then you guys figured it out and nailed it. So I mentioned you had a lot of hooks already.
There were quite a significant ones. Like, we found a bunch of cases where there are limitations. Like, generics is one case where we found, COM itself appears, they don't have generics in them. Mm-hmm. Because interop assemblies definitely didn't have generics. But it's okay, you know. But you could pull in one of those interfaces and use it in a generic container. Mm. iList, right? List of food.
Yep.
So based on how the CLR is implemented right now, so we found it's not easy to make a list of iFoo equivalent to another list of a different iFoo. Mm. But it's you know, iList of iFoo. It's easier to make it equivalent to iList of iFoo prime, for example. That's one example. And we found a few cases like that, actually, where, like, you know, we have to provide guidance for people saying, if you're using Nopia, if you want to use the peer-based interfaces in your public signatures, you know, you don't get to put list of iFoo there, you have to put iList of iFoo. Hmm. Which has been a general framework guideline, yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And then from engineering-wise, we have engine, code sharing. As I said, like, we had a couple of good devs who actually looked at it and found, like, you know, all the places where we have to be careful about, and found some cases where we missed. Mm-hmm. Genics was one good example. The other one was...
My feeling is most of the places we really ran into tricky problems are the places where you could use this feature outside of the interop scenarios. Mm. So if you're just using interop, you're just using VB and C# with the compiler implemented as it was generally not that hard. Most of the difficult places were when you tried to do something or a little different where it didn't make sense in the interop case, like generics, for example. But you could imagine someone typing it in, and you could definitely imagine an IL as in being able to generate these types of assemblies. And like you said, we have to work regardless of what compiler uses our features. So most of the tricky design was trying to figure out how this all should work going forward, given that there will be other designers and other languages that do these types of things, not strictly in the interop scenarios. Mm-hmm. And so it was figuring out all those cases that most people won't see today when they use Office and VS and C# and VB, but they're likely to start seeing over time as this expands beyond a basic interop scenarios on C# and VB. So that was the tricky part.
Absolutely. And another question I would have is, in the sense of Office, you know, using Office as an example again, let's say Office releases an update to their API, right, their COM API, and you're somebody that's using a Nopia programming against this API.
Right.
I would imagine in the old days you'd be able to take their new Pia and shove it into the GAC. Right? Maybe you wrote some smart kind of updating mechanism.
Oh, they had to shove it into the GAC, and then they had to create this thing called publisher policy to make sure that people could use this new version of the GAC. And it's actually kind of an odd, crazy feature. Mm. You write a bunch of XML, and then you somehow compile it into an assembly using a series of tools. I've done it a bunch of times, but I always have to look up the process whenever I do it, because it's kind of odd. And then you have to install this publisher policy assembly into the GAC. And the part I find most amusing about all that is that once you do that, the GAC installation process extracts your original XML file and sticks it to the GAC anyways. It's basically a convoluted process to install XML into the GAC.
Okay.
And uses a DLL as the middleman.
Mm.
So, and what that does is it lets people who compiled against the old version of the Office PO use the new version of the Office PO.
Without recompiling.
Without recompiling and be able to exchange types with someone who coded against the new version of the Office PO.
Yes.
Now we don't have that problem because you have your embedded definition
mm-hmm.
and you don't care. You're typically only consuming these objects.
Understood.
So if you get back an object and there's a few extra members at the end of the vtable, you don't care, but you're never trying to call them.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll still be able to exchange with somebody else because when Office revved, they didn't change their GUIDs or anything like that, of course. They usually just add to the end of the interface.
Excellent, man.
And so that publisher policy is one of the downsides we did not go into earlier, but has been a continuous pain for anybody who keeps revving their interop definitions over time.
Yeah, if you talk to the VSTO team, they talk about light up quite a bit, actually. It's like, hey, how can I build an add-in that runs on, like, you know, one version of the Office, but when I'm running on a new version of the Office, it can actually detect it and use the new functionality. With the existing model, like, you know, you have to pick a peer and bind to it, right? So if you bound to the new peer, then you won't load in the old ones.
Mm.
But if you bind to the old ones, you can run on the new ones with all this publisher policy stuff, but you don't get to light up. With Nopia, there's an opportunity for you to actually pull in the new interface and old interfaces, but still, you have to be careful. I'm going to use new ones only when I'm running a new version of the Office. If you're careful, I think it provides an opportunity to light up. But, yeah.
Mm. Excellent. So.
But it does at least remove the need for publisher policy in these cases going forward, which
is huge.
Which is going to be thankfully received by the teams that used to have to deploy it themselves.
I bet. Yeah.
And the teams on this team that had to help those people actually do it successfully.
Perfect. Well, hey, I mean, I'm sure developers will play around with this when you guys release beta.
There's a few tweaks that didn't make it into beta 1, but then again, those are the ones that you wouldn't notice if you're just going through the most into C# and VB. So play with beta 1, let us know. It should be
try and break it.
Try and break it. Let us know if you do.
Mm-hmm.
File bugs.
So you have time to react.
Yes.
Yeah. as he was pointing out, like we know a few things that didn't make it into beta 1.
Yeah.
And we're still looking at it to make sure, like, you know, all the edges are rounded up. So play with it. If you have feedback, I'd love to hear it.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Well, hey, thanks for your time, you guys, and congratulations on this milestone.
Thank you.
It's awesome.
Thank you.
Cool. Cheers.